The Fairness Doctrine was a policy of the United States Federal Communications Commission introduced in 1949 that required the holders of broadcast licenses both to present controversial issues of public importance and to do so in a manner that was, in the Commission's view, honest, equitable, and of course balanced.
Hello, Boston. Hello, New England. Chuck Morse co-hosting The Fairness Doctrine Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 p.m. here at WDIS AM 1170, WNSH AM 1570. I am live here at our studio in Norfolk, Massachusetts. My co-host, Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan, is live in his studio in San Francisco. Patrick, how are you?
I'm pretty good. In fact, I took my bike out for a good long ride yesterday, and I'm not sore.
Well, that's good. You're kind of a fitness sort of a guy.
I used to be. I'm trying to get it back.
Have you ever worked out regularly in gyms?
Yeah, I try to get to the gym about three times a week. I do some of the bike, stationary bike, and stretching and weightlifting.
I admire that. I've never had the discipline for it.
It does take discipline, too, particularly when you're sore.
Right, right. I mean, I've always been into more kind of solitary sports. But somehow, it doesn't I mean, I've done it. I actually did well with Fitness Together for a while.
But now, what is Fitness Together?
Fitness Together, I think that they're in New England. They actually sponsored me on a previous radio program where I basically went there and had a personal trainer, worked out a couple of times a week. This guy put me through the paces. You know, it's kind of the pressure of having somebody watching over me added to the social pressure of it. I didn't have the discipline to do it alone. And then I'd bring him on the air once in a while, and we'd talk about Fitness Together and personal training.
Hey, that's a great idea.
It was good. I'm trying to work out something like that now, to tell you the truth.
I'd love it.
The context story.
The context story, yeah. This is a positive corporate story.
Why not? Most of them are.
No reason why not. After all, it's corporations that give us the jobs that we all need. Today's context is actually from the Seattle Times. The Bank of America, which is the largest mortgage lender in the country, announced last night a program to offer homeowners who owe significantly more than their homes are worth, that's called being underwater, the opportunity to reduce their loan balances. Now, this settles a Massachusetts investigation of lending practices by Countrywide Financial, which Bank of America acquired in 2008. But it's even bigger than the Massachusetts investigation. The program, which will start in May, could help 45,000 homeowners nationwide. And frankly, in launching this effort, the Bank of America is jumping into the debate about how to address the millions of homeowners whose mortgages exceed the values of their home. And they're saying, you know, we really want to help these people, and these people have told us this is what they need. And so we're going to do it. Bank of America expects to give about $3 billion in principal on loans as part of the program. That's $3 billion that's going to disappear off their balance sheet. Now, there was a settlement agreement the Bank of America made with several state attorneys generals in 2008 to modify thousands of mortgages, but this is actually a really positive step forward because a number of studies have shown that people whose homes are underwater are most likely to default even if they can pay the mortgage because they don't see any point to it. So
Right. Hats
off to Bank of America.
Well, it's also good business in that Bank of America doesn't have to be taking possession of foreclosed properties. They can get people situated in such a manner that they can start to make payments, even if they're obviously taking away some of the underwater aspect of the loan. They're still going to start to develop steady income, at least, from these properties at interest. So, you know, it's good business, and oftentimes what's good business is what's good. I think that Henry Ford said it best. When once asked, he said that he wants to pay people well enough in his company so that they can afford to own the cars that he's selling.
Hey, that's a great idea.
Well, you know, this is most businesses, I think, do see it that way. I think business generally gets a bad rap. They're not all like Goldman Sachs, which apparently today is handing out more bonuses, even though they took taxpayer money.
I saw that, yeah.
But, of course, the problem with them is that the government got involved in it and reduce their risk factor. If they had to deal with the vicissitudes of the open market, like right now the Bank of America is doing, they might have responded a little differently because otherwise they would have been in the unemployment lines instead of standing there getting a couple of, however many millions in bonuses.
You're right. Unfortunately, at some point it was kind of hard to tell the difference between Goldman Sachs and the government because there were so many Goldman Sachs peoples in the Treasury Department.
It has been a revolving door with Robert Rubin and I think Geithner and Summers. And I mean, they all seem to – you know, there seems to be an elite that they're not particularly liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican. They just sort of revolve back and forth between corporate head and government.
Yeah, there is. I think the last Secretary of the Treasury, Paulson, was also from Goldman Sachs.
He was. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, and I bet you that, you know, you could look at a lot of people that sort of, they go, it's like, as I say, a revolving door. It goes in and out, and it does seem to me to have somewhat of a conflict of interest. I'd even point a finger maybe at former Vice President Cheney, even though I think he was a great man. Still, you know, Halliburton, first he's in Congress, then Halliburton, then back into government. I mean, it seems to be a typical phenomena on both sides. Timothy Geithner is an example.
Well, I think there's now a law that forbids members of Congress and their staff from going to work in the private industry
after they leave office. Yeah,
after they leave for 2 years. But that law apparently, and I have to check, maybe our listeners can let us know on this, apparently does not apply to political appointees or cabinet secretaries.
Well, I mean, I would think that it would be the other way around myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, the point I'm making is that in the broad sense, when the private sector is left to its own devices, I think most of the time it does the right thing, and I think it does the right thing because, not necessarily because it's the moral thing to do, but because it's the practical thing to do. And in the case of Bank of America, they are taking practical steps that will lead to long-term profits, and that's good.
That's
because it's good for everybody.
And I also noticed that even though a number of studies have shown that the heads of the Wall Street firms that disappeared as a result of the meltdown all walked away with fairly hefty bonuses and bank accounts, that as of now, many of the banks, particularly all of those that took TARP money, now have to pay their executives in stock that they can't sell or transfer for a number of years. So they have to look at the long-term health of their companies rather than the short-term health, the quarterly reports, and that's a good thing.
Well, they already sheared off their piece, and again, this is a situation where you had government reducing the risk, and the worst offenders of all, I think, were the quasi-government agencies, Fannie and Freddie. But we're going to take a brief break. We'll be back with Eric Stone. We're talking Blackwater and other mercenaries in the U.S. Defense Department and Defense Forces. You're listening to The Fairness Doctrine. Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan, yours truly, Chuck Morse. We'll be right back.
Beacon Hill Wine and Gourmet is bringing the boutique wine shop experience to the next level. Beacon Hill Wine and Gourmet, conveniently located in downtown Melrose, Mass., is ready to help you explore the world of wine, cheese, and all things gourmet. Featuring a large variety of wines, Beacon Hill Wine & Gourmet offers artesian cheese and gourmet specialties, ranging from truffle butters and oils to fresh pastas and homemade chocolates, as well as entertaining giftware. Add something special to your wine glass, your dinner table, and your life. In-store tastings, commercial and residential private classes, gift baskets, wine education, and much more. From the ordinary to the extraordinary. Beacon Hill Wine & Gourmet believes that fine wine doesn't have to be expensive. It just has to be good. An injured person has legal rights. Those rights can expire or diminish if an injured person fails to act on a timely legal filing. It's always best to know what your legal rights and obligations are. If you or a family member have been injured in a car accident, through medical malpractice, or injured in any other way in Massachusetts, you may call the office of Albert E. Grady. A toll-free number is coming up in a moment. The office of Albert E. Grady will give a free telephone consultation to people for injuries sustained in Massachusetts. There is no obligation to proceed on after that telephone consultation. If you do elect to retain the office of Albert E. Grady, inquire about contingency representation. Here is the toll-free number for all Massachusetts injury inquiries, 1-800-322-9022. The call is free. The information is free. Call now, and an attorney will assist you. The toll-free number again is 1-800-322-9022. That's 1-800-322-9022.
And we are back. You're listening to The Fairness Doctrine. Chuck Morse, Patrick O'Heffernan. Patrick, why don't you do the honors?
Thank you, Chuck. I'd like to introduce Eric Stoner, a writer based in New York who has published widely on the issue of mercenaries in U.S. defense and diplomatic contracts. And he's also assisted Jeremy Scahill in assembling his now well-known book, Blackwater. Eric is an adjunct professor at St. Peter's College. His articles have appeared in The Guardian, Mother Jones, The Nation, In These Times, The Pittsburgh Post, and many other places. Eric, welcome to The Fairness Doctrine.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Eric, we asked you to come on because frequently Chuck and I discuss the role of Blackwater and other mercenaries in the U.S. Wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, and we'd like to get our facts straight. As I can see it, the use of mercenaries, it does not seem to be a partisan issue. It's grown under both parties. So I wonder, could you tell us, why do organizations like Blackwater and Armor Group and Triple Canopy get U.S. contracts? Why do we need them at all?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think you'd probably get different answers to that from different people. I think, you know, there was somewhat of a downsizing, I guess, maybe after the fall of the Soviet Union. And, you know, there was, for a brief period, kind of a push for, you know, something like a peace dividend, you know, they were calling it. Or, you know, there was a moment when there was actually somewhat of a downsizing of the number of folks in the army and the military. And I think it was during really the first Bush administration where they, you know, when Cheney was Secretary of Defense, there was kind of this idea that we should try to, you know, bring in the private sector more to kind of fill that role.
You mean Rumsfeld?
And Rumsfeld kind of picked up on that once he became Secretary of Defense.
Ah, okay.
But I'm talking about the first Bush administration back in, you know, in the early 90s.
Desert Storm.
Yes, Desert Storm. So there was a kind of a move towards privatization at that point, and that's kind of when the log cap, the huge logistics contract, was first conceived, and that's when, you know, Halliburton kind of came in, kind of in, I think, 94, 95, and got that first contract, and then really the first time that there was privatization or escalation of the privatization of the security component was in the under the Clinton administration during the kind of reinstatement of Aristide in Haiti, there was a large contract there to kind of fill the role of diplomatic security and whatnot in Haiti at that point. And then, you know, once George W. was elected, you know, that kind of escalated dramatically under the Rumsfeld, you know, while Rumsfeld was in the Pentagon.
Well, whenever I've been to a U.S. embassy abroad, the security is always U.S. Marines. And I don't quite understand why we have to hire private companies to provide that security. The U.S. Marines not only do a fabulous job, but they also project an image of America. I mean, they are American military forces, and America has the best military in the world. Why do we need these people at all? What has been the thinking behind the Bush, Clinton, and Bush administrations to contract out our defenses?
Well, I think there, you know, one answer would be that, you know, turning it over to the private sector, you know, frees up some of those Marines and other Army officers and soldiers to kind of be more on the front lines and, you know, to have more of the static operation, you know, static guard operations and, you know, security stuff for convoys, that kind of thing, turned over more to private companies. So that's one idea. A more critical take on it would be that, there's actually obviously less accountability for these companies, and so it also gives the administration more kind of political, you know, wiggle room or, you know, kind of political cover to, you know, escalate, you know, increase the number of folks over there without really getting a lot of public attention.
Well, when you say accountability, we've seen a number of reports of scandals. Blackwater, a former Blackwater employee, has accused them of essentially murdering people, smuggling weapons into the country. We have the fiasco of the alcohol and sex parties outside the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan, and on and on. Aren't these people accountable to either the contractors or to U.S. law?
I mean, that's one of the big problems with this all along, is that there really hasn't been any law that's been applicable, and there have been attempts to kind of try to bring them in under different laws. So one effort was made to actually make them accountable under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I think Lindsey Graham inserted that into one of the defense bills, and it was passed, but I don't know of that ever being actually used. Another effort, some arguments have been made that contractors fall under the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, which was designed to hold, you know, Pentagon contractors accountable for abuses or corruption or whatnot that were, working for them. But the problem is that a lot of these guys, the large Blackwater contracts, Triple Canopy contracts, Armor Group, a lot of these people are working for the State Department, and so they actually don't really fall under the military act. So there is this kind of gray zone where they really haven't fallen under anything. There also was this immunity that was given by Paul Bremer, when he kind of passed these 100 decrees while he was running the CPA, Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq for that first year after the invasion. He passed these decrees that basically gave kind of a blanket immunity to contractors, including the armed contractors. And recently, when that status of forces agreement in Iraq was agreed to, they actually lifted that kind of blanket immunity so that the contractors could potentially in Iraq fall under Iraqi law. But I also really don't know of any instances of that happening since that happened. So as far as I know, there still really is no legal mechanism to hold these guys accountable for abuses or crimes.
Well, I know Chuck has equally as many questions as I do. So, Chuck.
Well, Eric, thanks for joining us. I think that in the case of Iraq, I understand that Blackwater has simply been basically kicked out of the country. I mean, the Iraqis did not renew their contract for various reasons, and I think as of 2007, I believe, they're no longer involved there. So, I suppose that they certainly have, at least in the formal sense, answered to the laws of the country that they're operating in. But my question is, I mean, it seems to me that that these guys are, it's not quite mercenary activity. They seem to be more involved in support services when the United States, for better or for worse, is involved in a prolonged occupation or engagement in a foreign country. What exactly is it that they do?
Well, I mean, they do a whole range of services. Some of the big contracts have been, like I mentioned, what they call static, security, which is, kind of defending the perimeters of the green zone or different embassies or consulates around Afghanistan or Iraq. They also have been tasked with kind of providing security for diplomatic convoys and congressional delegations and
right.
things like that. And also, a lot of them are actually hired by other contractors. So that is where it gets kind of murky in terms of even trying to determine how many people are over there, because, a lot of the contractors are hiring their own companies, and the reporting isn't very clear on even how many are there. But there's been some recent revelations, particularly around Blackwater, that kind of really dramatically expand the kinds of things that they're doing in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I guess primarily Afghanistan now. Like you said, actually, in Iraq, they officially kicked them out just a couple weeks ago.
Right.
They kind of lingered with a couple of contracts.
But for the most part, they were gone. And
they're gone. Yeah, they kicked out the last, you know, 200-300 like literally a couple of weeks ago. But in Afghanistan, you know, there's been a bunch of stories that have broken, you know, over the last couple months that have shown that, you know, they've been involved with the special forces, planning special forces operations, and actually going on what they call snatch and grab raids, doing kind of targeted assassination stuff, working with CIA,
right. But
putting,
it's really
onto drones.
It's really support services. I mean, they're not frontline combat. But Patrick made reference, and we've talked about this before, this charge that they'd been involved in Iraq and murdering people.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get some clarity on that. I mean, were they going out and deciding to blow up a few people, or was this what was the situation? What was the context in which people were killed? Do you have any information on that?
We probably don't need to rehash the whole Nisr Square thing. I imagine most listeners would be aware of that, you know.
Not necessarily.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, yeah, there was the most kind of infamous shooting that's happened in either war was involving contractors was the Nisr Square shooting in September of 2007, where there was this the Blackwater guards who were kind of on a convoy with State Department folks were open fire in the middle of one of the busiest intersections of Baghdad and ended up killing 17 innocent civilians and injuring 20-some others. And so, you know, that caused a huge kind of uproar in the country where diplomatic convoys were suspended for several days and, you know, the Iraqi government was calling for the, you know, expulsion of these guys. And it really created a lot of problems for the military as well.
Right, but the question is, why did what exactly happened? I mean, I don't think that they was deciding, gee, we're going to go up and blow up people at an intersection. You know, I mean, again, I'm not a military man, so I can't really put myself in their shoes, but I would imagine if I was in a country where you had suicide bombers blowing themselves up and, you know, you might be in a situation where your job is to protect somebody, and somebody might either, you know, be doing something that looks suspicious or they're not answering my request that they do something, you know, you might have a situation where people resort to that. And I'm not excusing it, but I think that it should be put into a context. It wasn't that they just went out to murder people.
No,
I wouldn't describe this as murder. I would describe it maybe as an overreaction to something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean – you know, I wasn't there. You can read the reports on terms of there's very detailed reports on what actually transpired that day and, you know, even kind of the stories from people who were on the scene, and there's stories from what happened even from the guards. And so there's different takes on it, but even the preliminary kind of military investigation and FBI investigation that happened immediately afterwards basically said that it was unprovoked, that it was, you know, basically, you know, the killing of innocent civilians. But I don't think I don't think they went into that with that intention.
Right. It just leaves an open question in terms of why they did it, because I don't think that they'd simply went in and decided to shoot someone up. We're talking about a time, this is before the surge, when you had, suicide bombers and snipers. You know, you might have had some people that were in Blackwater who maybe weren't as experienced as they should have been. They might have been frightened. Who knows what? But I feel like sitting here in Norfolk, Massachusetts, it's easy to criticize. And I don't think that it's quite right to say that they murdered someone or that they're in there just, you know, swaggering around, you know, shooting up people, which is the image that seems to be drawn in some quarters.
I mean, even I was just reading before this interview here some quotes from, you know, military commanders in Iraq that have been pretty critical of Blackwater and other, you know, armed contractors, and they actually say things very similar to what you just said, though. So they, you know, calling them basically kind of cowboys that are swaggering and think they know everything. And I mean, it, you know, from what I can tell, most of the military folks who have commented publicly on this have very critical things to say about how they perceive, you know, these guys in the country and what their effect is on the occupation, you know, and everything. So, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of other incidences. You know, that was just the most famous. Another one involving Blackwater was where a guard in the green zone after a Christmas party where I think he was drunk ended up shooting, you know, the guard for the Iraqi vice president.
Yeah, got into an argument with him. There's information about that.
You know, things like that happen somewhat regularly. A lot of times it seems that drinking is involved. And so, you know, there's a lot of incidences. You know, when there were some congressional hearings on this, they kind of actually tried to calculate the number of shootings, and it went into the hundreds, and the majority of them were situations they determined where, you know, Blackwater or Dying Corp or, you know, these other companies opened fire first. And that's all based on actually self-reporting. So
right, but I mean, again, you'd have to look at the context of each of these cases. You might have had a situation where, you know, again, they're hired as guards and somebody might not be doing what they thought they were supposed to do. And, you know, people are disguising themselves and blowing themselves up. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are, as the old saying goes in diplomatic circles, mistakes have been made.
Eric, if I recall, the two Blackwater guards who were indicted for the Square shootings were actually either the charges were dismissed against them. Is that correct?
Yes, that is true. I think that happened at the end of December.
Yeah. Okay.
The basis was that you know, once the investigation started afterwards, the State Department basically gave the guards, you know, immunity for their statements, and then there was, they called it prosecutorial misconduct, that you know, they couldn't use their statements as evidence in the trial or any evidence that came out because of those statements. So it wasn't really finding them not guilty. It was just that the government mismanaged the case.
It was a technicality. I noticed that there were two former Blackwater employees who remained John Doe's, who submitted sworn affidavits to the court saying that Eric Prince, the founder and CEO of Blackwater, quote, views himself as a Christian crusader tasked with eliminating Muslims and the Islamic faith from the globe. And that, like I say, that was in a sworn statement. And later on he said that, quote, going to Iraq to shoot and kill Iraqis was viewed as sport or game. Are those just really outrageous statements that have no basis in fact, as far as you know?
I mean, I really don't know. You've probably read the same things that I've read. I mean, it's some of it's so unbelievable that I mean, I'm not willing. You know, I can't say that it's not true or that it is true. But you know, the fact that they were willing to give these sworn statements and really there's been so many different lawsuits that have popped up, you know, over the last year and a lot of things that just seem unbelievable.
Yeah, there's 24 lawsuits against them now.
No.
I wanted to get to another topic dear to both Chuck and my heart, and that is it cheaper to hire these people or more expensive? I know that they're getting paid 5, 10, 20 times as much as soldiers. Wouldn't we save more money as taxpayers if we just recruited more people?
I think so, yeah. I mean, their rates, their wages have gone down as these wars have gone on because of, you know, more companies in the business and you know, more supply. There's at the very beginning, they were getting something like $1,200 a day, you know, per person.
Well, it's a very hazardous job.
Down to $400-$500 a day.
Sure. I mean, it's not the kind of job that, I mean, you have to put out some pretty good money to get people to go to a place like Iraq and do what's basically non-military services. But as far as, I don't know about Prince, I mean, I think that that's of concern, his beliefs, his personal beliefs, but I'm not sure, which are, you know, what, I don't know about commenting one way or the other. But either way, I'm not sure that those beliefs are necessarily reflected in the policies of Blackwater. I don't know if they're going out and just shooting people, and I don't think there's any evidence that they are. But these jobs are very hazardous jobs, which is why I think they have to pay people pretty well. I mean, you can't get somebody. People like this one guy who was one of the people that eventually, I believe, was hanging from the bridge over the Tigris River, who was a Blackwater employee. He said that, you know, he left his family in Texas and took this job because he needed the money. I mean, it was a very well-paying job. It was a six-figure salary, and that's what it takes, because you're asking people to do something that's extremely hazardous. The price of that is very high.
But most of these people get recruited from developing countries? They're not Americans?
Well, yeah, there's a couple interesting points there. Yeah, I was just looking up kind of some of the statistics on this, and it actually differs between Iraq and Afghanistan. So in Iraq, this is according to a Congressional Research Service report that came out in January, 70% of the folks in Iraq, the armed contractors, are what they call third country nationals, which means that they're neither Iraqi nor, you know, American. And a lot of them come from the developing world. They come from Latin American countries or South Asian countries, Southeast Asian countries. A lot of them are actually very poorly paid. Some of them, I think the going rate in Latin America is $1,000 a month. It's pretty low. But the Americans and the British and Special Forces, ex-Special Forces folks are very well paid. In Afghanistan, it's different. 90% of the armed contractors are locals, are Afghanis, and 9% are from third country nationals, and less than 1% are American. So that's pretty interesting.
So they're taking jobs away from American soldiers.
So, you know, one thought about the whole, you know, are they more cost-effective, is that, you know, the argument that's made that they're more cost-effective is that, you know, they, when they're working for a private company, they're responsible for, you know, health care and, you know, that kind of stuff, the long-term benefits that these folks will get. But the fact is that, you know, most of the Americans are, like I said, ex-Special Forces, and so they've actually, the government, the military has actually already poured a huge amount of money into training these folks, and then they basically leave for the private sector.
You know, I would think that if we're going to have U.S. military personnel do these jobs, it's going to require such a massive expansion in the Army that there's going to have to be a re-implementation of the draft. There's no other way. I don't think there are enough volunteers in the volunteer army to do these jobs, and they're not directly related to the military. So, Eric, you've done some pretty good research on this. What are your conclusions in terms of what the best policy is going forward regarding the contracting out of the services?
Well, I think that issue that you raise is an important one, and the issue of kind of, you know, and prosecute these wars if it wasn't for the contractors, and I think people would say that we could. That they become so integral to, you know, how the Pentagon runs and to you know, to these different wars that you know, we really couldn't do it without them.
Right.
I guess the question would be, you know, what does that say about our democracy? You know.
Well, it's a public policy question whether we should be in these wars at all.
Yeah.
And I think that's a legitimate debate. We probably shouldn't be in some of them, but the fact is we are, and as long as we are. The question is, what is the best way to conduct them in a manner that that's effective and that doesn't overtax the military?
I mean, I honestly, you know, there's one of the big debates is, you know, over regulation, you know, and how do we get some kind of effective regulation on these guys, and that a lot of people think that that's the solution to the problem, including, you know, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, I think, believed in this kind of reform option. And I'm really skeptical of that. I think that it's hard for me to imagine being able to really hold these guys accountable, that there's any kind of law that could really rein it in. And I don't know. I guess I would be supportive of kind of what would be an extreme action would be you know, the Stop Outsourcing Security Act, which was just introduced, which basically says that, you know, we need to try to phase these guys out of, you know, armed roles and some of the security roles, you know, over the next year or something. And
who was the sponsor of that bill?
Jan Schakowsky in the House.
Now, is there any aspect of the bill that calls for some sort of an alternative if they are phased out?
I mean, I think they just call for basically, you know, stepping up recruitment of diplomatic security and kind of training, you know, a lot more folks in diplomatic security and
right.
Things like that. So it's mainly just, you know, at one point, you know, it wasn't always this way. You know, the military used to do these things, and
it was always the Marines. That was one of a pride thing to guard the embassies.
I mean, it's not like this. It has to be this way, or that it has always been this way.
Yeah, but there's a much different matter when you're guarding an embassy in a wartime in a war zone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one thing to guard the embassy of Luxembourg. You know, I mean, but I mean, I think that generally speaking, if you take a look at, and I'm not in favor or against. I mean, I'm here to learn. But if you look at the overall record of these subcontractors, given the massive level of these engagements, I think it's pretty good. And I think that there is at least some oversight in the host countries, and there's some level of training. I would hope. And I think if you look at the overall, you know, ratios of good work, I think most of it has been very good and effective.
What do you think of that, Eric?
I mean, I don't know. I guess I tend to disagree. You know, I think that they're really, I don't know of any armed contractors that have been you know, found guilty of any crimes against an Iraqi or Afghan national over the entire course of the wars. So, and given the fact that there's literally been tens of thousands of these guys that have kind of filtered through there, it seems like there's something missing.
Well, I think the fact that there have been tens of thousands of them with such few instances is pretty remarkable. And again, I'm not excusing the mistakes that were made. I think that most of those also need to be viewed in context, which is what we started talking about. But we're involved in a very difficult situation over there. And whether we should be there or not is a legitimate debate, but we're there. And if we're going to be there, we have to take care of our own people and try to rebuild the country.
Well, the number of incidences that our military have been involved in is minuscule. And our military has not been involved in drunken parties, in shooting of guards, of their own guards, of Iraqi guards, have not been found to be smuggling weapons. I
agree with that, Patrick, but I don't think that these people are not quite up to snuff in terms of being at the military level.
No, and
so the question is, should we have them all these jobs handled by the military? I think that would be much more expensive in the long run, and I don't think the American people are prepared for the reimplementation of the draft.
I don't think you're talking about the draft. There's 58,000 mercenaries in Iraq right now, according to Eric's reporting. That's a brigade. That's not the draft. There's 170,000 total in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's three brigades. You don't need a draft for three brigades. We're not talking about a million people like you would with the draft. I think that what we have here is the private sector has slowly worked its way in on a contract basis, and they're on a gravy train. They're ripping off us taxpayers, and they're hiring cheap labor overseas. They're not training them. They're putting in a war zone. Military people, Marines and soldiers, are trained to handle what goes on in Iraq and in Afghanistan. These people that Triple Canopy and Blackwater are hiring aren't trained for it, and they aren't disciplined, and I think we're getting robbed as taxpayers because of it.
Well, what do the military people say about it? Do they feel that they should take on this position?
You know, I have never seen it really phrased that way. The only thing that I have seen, like I mentioned, is in general, they seem to be pretty critical of the effect of these guys, you know, and how they seem to get blowback when something like this happens, and that it, you know, that the Iraqis or Afghans don't really distinguish between the military contractors, and so some of these incidences that have happened have have, you know, made their job a lot more difficult.
Oh, no question. I'm sure when these very rare instances happen,
but,
it hurts everybody.
Like what you were saying about this being rare, I think we just really can't know.
Right.
You know, like I was saying, there was a report in the Washington Post a couple years ago about the number of shootings that have happened, and they interviewed former employees from these companies and former security, you know, former military officials, and they basically, you know, said that, you know, it is based on a system of self-reporting, so they're supposed to report their own shootings, and that there was estimates that maybe only 15% of the shootings have actually been reported.
Okay, we're on our way. We're going to go to a break, but thanks for joining us, Eric. By the way, do you think that Bush is to blame for all this?
I don't. I think it's a pretty bipartisan thing.
Eric Stoner, thanks so much for joining us. You're listening
to
The Fairness Doctrine. We shall return after these messages.
Don't be bothered anymore by bill collectors, salespeople, or unwanted nuisance calls. My service unblocks private or restricted phone calls so you know who's calling. You have the freedom to choose which calls to pick up and which to ignore. My service works easily with Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile for only $10 a month. Don't be bothered by annoying calls who refuse to identify themselves. Call toll-free 866-751-8518. That's 866-751-8518.
Awaken your inner monkey with Adena Holistics, the refreshing new line of herbal and fruit-flavored tonics made with 100% USDA organic certified ingredients. Adena Holistics introduces 7 low-cal, great-tasting flavors, tapping into the 5,000-year-old emerging trend of Ayurveda, used for centuries as a natural way to restore balance, harmony, and wellness.
Look for Hanuman, the warrior monkey,
on the Adena Holistic labels at fine stores near you, or log on to our website and tell us what makes your monkey happy at adenaworld.com.
Choices. Leave more cash in your pocket and improve your office when you purchase office supplies at www.recycledofficeproducts.com, a full-line office and computer supply company located in Peabody, Mass., with over 5,800 recycled and remanufactured products. Your choice, recycled or virgin. Thousands of choices. Unlike the superstores, items ready for prompt delivery next day. We offer printing services, checks, custom binders, indexes, all with recycled stocks and soy-based inks. Check out our extensive programs that we have developed to help you at work and home. Together, we all can get through these tough times. Try browsing our website at www.recycledofficeproducts.com. It's the right choice. Please call with any questions, 1-800-814-1100.
And we are back, The Fairness Doctrine, Chuck Morse, Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan. Patrick, things are getting awfully wild and woolly out there, wouldn't you say?
In what context?
In the context of the reaction to the health care situation.
Yes, it's all over the media that there have been death threats to 10 members of Congress, and I think 5 members of Congress have had their offices vandalized. I know Boehner was on television this morning repeating that he was saying this is unacceptable. But and I do think it's unacceptable, too.
Well, I think everyone does.
Yeah, absolutely. Now,
but people are angry.
A very tiny little portion of the population is angry, not people in general.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people are angry. There's a very tiny portion that's actually acting out like this.
No, actually, the polls that came out this morning show that fewer people are angry than they were Friday, that the approval rate of the health care bill has actually gone up, and the members of Congress who voted for its approval rate have gone up, too. But there is anger out there.
To what degree?
We're talking 9 points maximum.
Right. Well, we'll see. But,
yeah.
You know, it's today, apparently immediately after, I think it was 14 or 15 states have filed lawsuits.
Oh, I think it's more than that. Yeah, it's 14 that I know of, plus 2 independent lawsuits on top of that, one from Virginia and I think one from Colorado.
Now, the case is pretty interesting, and they all are different, but there's one basic similarity, and that, I think, gets to the crux of the matter, and it addresses the fundamental flaw in this program and what is unprecedented, and that is that there is nothing in the Constitution, according to these cases, that allows the federal government to force people to buy something. Now, that's the main issue. The secondary issue is, on top of that, when the federal government is subsidizing people who can't afford to buy it, basically people are not only forced to buy this, but they're forced to pay for their neighbor to buy it.
Well, as you know, you and I agree that the mandate's a bad idea.
Well, that's the core thing of this whole program.
Well, I wouldn't say it's the core thing, but it's one of the principal pillars of it.
What else is there when you take that away?
Well, there's the regulation of the insurance companies, which is a big deal. In fact, it's probably the biggest deal.
Well, that would have been fine, but the thing that makes this different and the thing that is the problem is this aspect that people are going to be forced to buy something that they may not want to buy. And I don't know where you fall on that, but I would make the case that it's unconstitutional. Now, one of the arguments that I've seen presented by those who say that it's okay is that, well, the government mandates such things as affirmative action, and they can insist that a company doesn't discriminate against someone because they're black, and so therefore this is okay as well because it's the federal government mandating something. But there's a real difference here. I mean, this is a positive law versus a negative law, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
In other words, a negative law, like, for example, taxation, which is another thing they're saying, well, we get income tax. That is a passive law. In other words, when you make income, when you get paid, the government takes a cut of what you've earned. They're not going out and actively forcing you to do something. I mean, it's you're going to do something voluntarily, and then they skim a little off the top.
And that's what provides you with all the services that we ask government
to
provide.
Well, that's another subject. But the point I'm making here is a philosophical one. The idea that this has something to do with the affirmative action, this is not like a government agency telling a company that they can't discriminate. This would be more analogous to a government telling a company that they would be required to hire somebody because they're black or for any reason. They're basically actively going in, and this is unprecedented.
It has
never been done before in American law, and it is what I've said it is, authoritarian and socialistic. This is typical of top-down authoritarian central states. I mean, this is the kind of thing that they do. I mean, it's one of the basic tools that they use. They can force a population to do one thing or the other by law and use the state to do that. And apparently, if someone doesn't do it, the government will be able to dun their bank accounts and all these other things. I mean, it's very troubling. And I don't know where people – I don't know if – I think most liberals, at least on the street, would be troubled by it as well, but they've gotten too into the emotional aspect that we have to hand over a victory to Obama, and the right wingers are against it, so we're for it, and all this kind of stuff.
Well, that's a little piece of it, but I think that at least most of the progressive polls that I see, the conversation I see on Daily Kos and the people I talk to, that wasn't the driving force. The driving force was to control the abuses of the insurance companies. As far as the mandating of purchasing, I think, and most of my progressive friends think, that the idea of the government handing over 30 million involuntary customers to the insurance companies is absolutely outrageous, and which is why Dennis Kucinich, up until almost the end, was against this. And I still think it's outrageous. You're right. It's absolutely unprecedented.
Yeah, but you're not answering. You're not.
Getting to that. Oh. I'm getting to that, okay? I don't see a place in the Constitution where the government does have the power to tell us to buy something. I don't see it in the Commerce Clause, which is the clause that's being supported. Now, I will notice that if this morning in the Washington Post, there was a column by Ezra Klein pointing out that at the last minute, there was a change made to the law that forbids the IRS specifically from enforcing this. Now, it says specifically, the law says that no criminal action or liens can be imposed on people who don't pay the fine, which is kind of an odd thing to do, but apparently the teeth were pulled out of this, and I don't know how that's going to come down, but I don't see any place in the Constitution where you can do this, and I really resent the government telling me I have to go buy insurance from a private company.
Your progressive friends are very situational in their opposition to this as opposed to fundamental.
Well,
and I'll tell you what I mean.
In other words,
They're not against the government forcing people to buy insurance. They just want to make sure that it doesn't go to the greedy private sector corporate interests.
No.
They want the money to go right to the government itself in universal health care. So
it's not
that they're against the idea. They like the idea of this enforcement. And not only that, Patrick, but it's a much more fundamental issue even than that. Because if we have this door opened and the government, the federal government, that is, we're not even talking states here, we're talking federal, has the power to force people to actively do something, then that opens up situations where they can force us to do a lot of other things, too.
It creates a precedent, and
that's how law works. You know that.
Well, the government has, in the past, forced us to actively do things. You have to register for the Selective Service if you're a male.
All right, well, we got rid of it.
You still have to register.
Well, you have to register, but you don't have to go in.
You have to register. They're
all right,
I'll grant you that,
and I think that's in the Constitution. But the point is, there was no
Selective Service when the Constitution was written.
Okay, well, maybe. Okay, so you've got me on one. But
okay.
Patrick, look,
all right.
The fact is that it's you know, and that's something I think, I don't know how far back the draft goes, or even Selective Service registration. But even then, it's not quite the same. To simply register somewhere is different than being forced to buy something with your money. I mean, this is a seizure of your property. If, in fact, you're right, and I think you could make that argument, what we're seeing is an unprecedented expansion of it beyond belief. Anyway, we're going to take a break for news.
Okay.
You're listening to The Fairness Doctrine. Chuck Morse, Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan. You're welcome to join the conversation. 508-384-8255, 508-384-8255. And now, news.